Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The jury has spoken. Jahar Tsarnaev sentenced to death.
The trial of this case has showcased an important American ideal, that even the worst of the worst deserve a fair trial and due process of law.
This is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After deliberating for 15 hours, a jury sentenced the 21-year-old Tsarnaev to death for his role in the Boston Marathon bombing that killed three people and injured more than 260 others.
It is a bittersweet. You know, there's no winner today, but I feel justice for my family. So I'm grateful that the jury took it serious enough to be able to, you know, sentence the appropriate sentence.
The verdict came surprisingly quickly and shocked many in a state where most oppose the death penalty.
The death sentence for Jahar Tsarnaev, coming up in a special hour of Radio Boston.
First, this news.
This podcast is a free service of WBUR. Please help us keep it free. Go to WBUR.org and click donate in the upper right-hand corner. And now back to the show.
From WBUR, this is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev has been sentenced to death.
After almost 15 hours of deliberation, jurors sentenced Tsarnaev to death on 6 of 17 counts, all related to the death of Lingzi Liu and Martin Richard. Here's U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz speaking outside the courtroom earlier today.
Today is not a day for celebration. It is not a day for political or moral debate. It is a day for reflection and healing. Our thoughts should now turn away from the Tsarnaev brothers for good and remain with those who will live in our memories forever.
That was U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz just after the jury handed down its sentence of death for Jahar Tsarnaev. She spoke outside of the Moakley Federal Courthouse. Joining us now from the courthouse is WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, who's been inside the courtroom day in and day out during this trial. And David, you were there inside the courtroom as Jahar Tsarnaev's sentence was being read. Put us inside. What was the mood like? What was it like being in there?
It strikes me that it was so much like the mood at the time that they read the verdicts in the conviction phase and the guilt phase. The people were very subdued. That room was tense, but they were subdued. I thought the tension was clear in the lawyers for both sides awaiting the arrival of the jury. They were all in their own space, so to speak. They were looking straight ahead. They weren't talking to each other. There was a silence there. The real drama came, as it did once before, with the jurors and that read. You know, when it gets down to it, these jurors are sentencing somebody to death. Their verdict is going to result, or may well result. It may take a long time. It may never happen, but it's intended to result in his death. And so they were nervous, standing there very, very nervously, rocking back and forth in some cases. Most of the emotion came after they delivered their verdict, six of them calling for the death penalty, and then some of them just broke down crying.
And what about Tsarnaev himself? Any reaction from him?
Inscrutable, as always, impassive, and, you know, appearing to be indifferent. And, of course, that is what, and now we have some evidence in the jury's verdict slips, that is what turned them off as well.
Mm. And, David, as we've mentioned, you have been following this trial from day one. What was your reaction when you heard the jury's decision?
There was something about this. There was an inevitability about it. It reminded me of the open of this case way back when in March. The evidence against Tsarnaev was always, from the start, it was overwhelming. His chances were desperate. People kept on saying, you know, this is Massachusetts. He's not going to get the death penalty. No, they're going to sentence him to life in prison without parole. Constantly, I heard people say, it's Massachusetts. This was a death-qualified jury, which meant that according to the federal death penalty statute, they were chosen, and they answered that they would be willing to impose death if they were persuaded by the evidence and the law. They were willing to do that. And so that immediately made them unrepresentative for the rest of Massachusetts. And then when it got to voir dire, well, before they were chosen, we had been in on voir dire, so we knew what various jurors who were ultimately selected to be on the jury had said, and what they had said made me think this was a jury that was ready to impose the death penalty. Mm. And in fact, it did, and it did pretty quickly.
Well, so David, pretty quickly, as you say, just in 2 days of deliberation, I mean, so that brings roughly to a close this portion of the trial, but definitely not the story at all. What happens next? Where does Tsarnaev go now?
So he will not be formally sentenced for a couple of months, and then they will have that hearing here. At that hearing, people, victims will be able, and families of victims who were killed that day will have the opportunity to make victim impact statements. It's probably the number of statements will probably be scaled down somewhat because, after all, six death penalties have been imposed here. So it'll be scaled back a little, but maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months, maybe 4 months, that will happen, and then the process begins. Mm-hmm. And it's an automatic appeal. I can tell you that there are all going to be all sorts of cases of grounds that will be attempted for appeal. And I don't consider myself an old man, but I'm telling you, and I wish myself good health, but I may well be in the grave before this is ever finalized.
That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri speaking to us from the Moakley Federal Courthouse. David, along with Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, are co-hosts of the WBUR podcast Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial. David, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you think the jury made the right decision? Will this help the city put this chapter behind it? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. To look a little more at what this means for the city and for a little more legal analysis, we're joined by Nancy Gertner. She's a Harvard Law School professor and a retired federal judge. Nancy Gertner, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
What's your reaction to the verdict?
Well, I was horrified, although not surprised. When the jury came back after this kind of short deliberation, you can only assume that it was unanimous in favor of death. At best, if it were a complicated issue, if it had been torturous for them, you would have expected a longer deliberation. But I was horrified.
Mm. And say more about that. Why?
Well, David started to say this. So this is, you cannot, in one sense, we have no business, quote, blaming the jury, end quote, because the jury was selected as the law required it be selected, at least with respect to death qualification. That means that they're perfectly representative of those people in Boston who believe in the death penalty,
mm-hmm.
right? They're the people who could impose the death penalty. The judge had to do that. You could no more have a drug trial, for example, where people didn't believe in the drug laws than have a death penalty case where someone says they can't impose death. But then that goes to the legitimacy of, for want of a better word, the engine of death here. That goes to the legitimacy of the system, that there could be a verdict that is so at odds with what this area believes.
When you bring up the question of the legitimacy, you're talking about a lack of support in Massachusetts, indeed in the Boston area, for the death penalty, right?
Right. But the government had a right. There's no question the government had a right to bring this as a death penalty case. There's no question that the judge had to ask the death qualification question. So then you step back and say, should we be doing death even under these circumstances? People say, on the one hand, this is the poster child for, you know, a death penalty case. In fact, I could argue the opposite. This is precisely the case in which we show our humanity.
Mm.
This is precisely the case in which we show we are different than Russia and China and Saudi Arabia and all the countries that have the death penalty. This was precisely the moment that it seems to me that we should have shown we were different, no matter how horrific the crime was, and it was horrific.
You know, Nancy, I was struck by something that Carmen Ortiz said that we just heard a moment ago. She said, our thoughts should now turn away from the Tsarnaev brothers for good and remain with those who live in our memories forever. But because of this sentence, our thoughts are probably not going to turn away from Tsarnaev for good.
will be years of appeals. Yeah. There are the appeals that we know about, now, the change of venue issues, the question of how the jury was selected. More significantly, why the trial had to be held now, why it had to be held on the anniversary of the second anniversary of the Marathon bombing. This is not a situation where evidence was going to disappear. It was, you know, so it's not just where, but when. And then there are the issues we don't know. A good deal of the case was sealed. The legal argument was sealed. And we'll know in days and weeks ahead what other issues there are. So there will be delay before there's the imposition of the death penalty. The lawyers are probably going to file post-trial motions challenging issues having to do with the trial. There'll then be an appeal. There'll then be an application to the Supreme Court if the appeal fails. And then there will be post-conviction, habeas corpus petitions. It's not for nothing that, notwithstanding the imposition of the death penalty, only three people have been executed in the United States, and the last time was decades ago.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of the fact that the mitigating factors that the defense had presented in an effort to save Sarnaev's life, that he was only 19, that he was led by his older brother, that he came from a dysfunctional family, that those didn't seem to carry much weight at all with this jury?
Well, you have to understand, first of all, this is these 12 people. This may not have been any jury that would have heard this case. That's one thing we should pause about. Mm-hmm. Death penalty imposed by these 12, and another jury might have done something different. You have to then say the judge makes all sorts of decisions about how much of the gore and horrible photographs and videos do you put in. Did he strike the right balance? Did he needlessly restrict the defense case? I think that those are the kinds of questions that the appeal will be addressing. Some jurors took into account Tamerlan's role, others did not. The death penalty decision is an enormously complex decision, weighing aggravating and mitigating factors. That's what's troubling about this. A different group of 12 could have decided something totally different.
Mm. Do you have any, I know it's really anybody's guess, but which arguments do you suppose from the prosecution, resonated most with jurors?
I wonder sometimes whether the most significant factor was not even what the evidence was, what the arguments that the government made, but Tsarnaev's impassivity. There are those who have done death penalty cases, and we in this area have no real background, who say that it's not unusual for a defendant to be impassive throughout the trial and the penalty phase, and then when the victims get up and say, "I forgive you," to then break down. So I wonder how much they were waiting for him to fall apart, and when he didn't, they had no sympathy for him. I wonder if that was more important. You remember many, many, many years ago, the Newton Nanny case. The Newton Nanny was accused of killing a child in her care.
That's right.
And when she took the stand, she was English, and she didn't cry. And numbers of the jurors who convicted her said that part of the reason was that she didn't show any emotion. Well, of course, some argued that that's sort of British and not, that's cultural, and not, only, Americans show their feelings all over the place. Mm. But that had been a very salient point. And I wonder whether that's was more important than almost anything.
Judge Gertner, if I may ask, I've heard you twice say that it's these 12 jurors who made this decision, and could it have been different if another 12 had been impaneled? While that may be true, these were the 12 who were impaneled. This is our system. I mean, is it worth even asking the hypothetical when, or is your criticism that of the system in and of itself?
That is my criticism. That's what I'm saying, that it is not these 12 in particular. The jury has decided. I sat as a judge as juries made decisions. I'm talking about a system that enables monumental discretion in the hands of ordinary citizens.
But it's fundamental to our criminal justice system.
Well, the death penalty is the only situation in which a jury makes a decision of death. In all other situations, the jury decides liability, yes or no, did he do it, and doesn't decide punishment. This is the only situation in our system where a jury decides punishment. And what we saw after the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty has to be imposed by a jury, that death verdicts went up. In fact, I've been reading Clarence Darrow's closing in Leopold and Loeb's case, and he waived the jury precisely because he worried about the ability of the jurors to empathize with his clients. You can't do that anymore. He went before a judge, and the judge granted life. Yes, it is a criticism of the system. I make no apology for that.
Listeners, we're talking about today's death sentence imposed on Jahar Tsarnaev. What do you think? Did the jury make the right decision? Will this help Boston put this behind us? You can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
Now, we've got a variety of opinions on this matter. We spoke a little earlier with the mother of two of the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing. That's Liz Norden. She's been at the courthouse every day of this trial. Her two sons, JP and Paul, each lost a leg in the bombings. And when we spoke with Liz, she told us about her reaction as she stood in the courtroom and heard that Jahar Tsarnaev was receiving the death penalty.
You know, I was honestly a little shocked, but I was grateful because I honestly felt that the prosecution did a fantastic job. And whatever the outcome was, I felt that whatever happened, it would be okay because they truly left no stone unturned. They told us early on that they would you know, give it their 100%, and I took the trial personally. My two sons lost their legs, and it affected my whole family. So for me, it was personal.
Mm. Have you had a chance to speak with your sons about what happened today?
I did. I did. I had a text. One of my sons was away on a fishing trip, and my other son, had texted them. You know, I felt like a weight was, like, taken off my shoulders with the verdict. It really... you know, there's no winners because it was split. A lot of people, you know, that we've come to know over the last 2 years, you know, had a different opinion. And I felt that, you know, what he did was just unbelievable. And I personally felt that there was no other form of justice.
Hmm. I'm wondering how you feel about the possibility of a really long and drawn-out appeals process that might keep Tsarnaev sort of in our collective consciousness for a long time. I mean, that was one of the reasons why the Richard family came out as being against the death penalty, because they just wanted this case to end and go away. But that may not happen now because there's certainly going to be a lot of appeals. And what do you think about that?
You know, I have, you know, become to know Denise and Bill, and I have the utmost respect for them and their opinions, and I feel terrible for what their family has to go through. And, you know, I honestly can't really comment on that because, not that I can't comment, and I feel terrible for them, and I truly feel terrible for them, but myself, I believe that what he did was heinous and terrible and destroyed many, many families that day. And if we didn't implement the death penalty, we have the death penalty for a reason. And if it wasn't implemented in a case like this, what do we have it for? So I feel terrible for people. You know, there was no winners today for nobody. It just, I personally feel justice was served.
Liz Norden, she's been at the courthouse every day of this trial. Two of her sons, as you heard, JP and Paul, each lost a leg in the bombings. Liz, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. We've got more discussion ahead on the death penalty handed down today to Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev ahead on this special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
This is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As we've been talking about, Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev has been sentenced to death.
After 15 hours of deliberations, jurors sentenced Tsarnaev to death on 6 of 17 counts, all related to the deaths of Lingzhi Liu and Martin Richard. Here's Governor Charlie Baker responding to the verdict earlier this afternoon.
At this point in time, I hope this represents some kind of closure for all of those who were affected by this tragedy. And I've always been and continue to be amazingly impressed by the ability of the people of this community to pull together around issues like this and to look forward. And that's certainly what I hope everybody does from this point forward.
And regarding all those people who've been affected by this tragedy, in a press conference outside the courthouse this afternoon, Karen Broussard, who was outside Marathon Sports when the first bomb went off 2 years ago and was injured, she spoke for the victims. She says today's verdict, or today's decision, does offer her a sense of closure.
Once the verdict came in, it was like, okay, now we can start from here and go forward and really feel like it's behind us.
And she said that though there are still things to come, she explains or feels a sense of relief.
I know that there's still a long road ahead. There is going to be many, many, many more dates ahead. But right now, it feels like we can take a breath.
We're joined by Nancy Gertner, former federal judge. Also with us is George Vian. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he was the prosecutor in the Gary Lee Sampson case. Gary Lee Sampson was sentenced to death in 2003. George Vian, welcome to Radio Boston. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I want to just go back to Nancy Gertner for one more question. I'll ask you both, actually. But Nancy Gertner, you know, one of the things we hear about for people who are in favor of this death penalty, and we heard it from Liz Norden just a moment ago, we have the statute on the books. If there ever was a time to impose it, it's this case. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I didn't agree with the statute to begin with, but, you know, one could have said that in two directions. Not every case of mass destruction has led to the death penalty. Zacharias Moussaoui got life. The Unabomber, who not at this kind of scope, got life. Gary Lee Sampson was a different case in that he dealt with an older man. This is a young man. And I don't think that even the government would say that had Tamerlan not been around, this crime would have happened. There were lots of reasons to have exercised mercy here. The jury chose not to do so. So, I mean, I think, and it's very troubling that we have a system that enables that.
Well, George Vian, you were the prosecutor in the Gary Lee Sampson case that Judge Gertner just mentioned. And it looks like we've just lost George Vian. So let's take some callers here. We have a lot of people who want to join us. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's start with Joan, who's calling from Wellesley. You're on the air, Joan.
Hello. I call because I'm normally against the death penalty. I feel that it's disproportionately given to people who are poor, minorities, maybe mentally ill, or people who never learned to read, and things like that. I feel that this is not Tsarnaev. Tsarnaev had an infusion of local, state, and federal funds put into his life, and he turned around and chose to become a terrorist, and he really terrorized people. And I don't know. I feel that this it's an appropriate punishment for him.
Joan,
I know that there's going to be appeals. So.
Joan, thank you so much for your call. Judge Gertner, let me just get your reaction to that.
Well, I think that the argument can go in both directions. I mean, on the one hand, again, I'm taking a line from Clarence Darrow's closing. He said that if the death penalty would deter one person, or if it would have brought back any of the victims, he would be for it. But there's no evidence of any of that. So it becomes pure retribution, pure eye for an eye.
Hmm.
And as I've said in other settings, wouldn't it have been something if this jury had chosen not to impose the death penalty, that we in this country can show Tsarnaev certainly more mercy than he showed any of the victims? What an indication of our, I don't know, our civilization. So I do think the argument about if not this case, then what case? First of all, there are distinctions that can be made in this case than with others. And if that argument it becomes a pure eye for an eye argument, which I don't accept and never have.
Well, let's go to George Vian. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he was the prosecutor in the Gary Lee Sampson case. Gary Lee Sampson was sentenced to death in 2003. George Vian, we lost you there, but you're back. Give us your response to the verdict today.
I thought the jury applied the law. I mean, if we're going to have a policy argument about the death penalty, that's certainly legitimate, and I have complete respect for people who oppose the death penalty under all circumstances, but we do have a death penalty statute. Attorney General Holder authorized the death penalty in this case. The jury did its job. Everything indicates that the jury applied the law and weighed the mitigating factors and the aggravating factors. And frankly, the defense team in this case, whom I have great respect for, they're all great lawyers, but they didn't have anything to work with. And the thing that was really stunning in the case, I thought, was the complete lack of remorse that the defendant showed at any time in the case.
Do you think that made was that the big difference in this case, or what do you think made the prosecution successful?
Well, obviously, the facts are just horrific. Mm-hmm. But what really helped him and hurt the defense in this case was the defense's case was based on two things. One, that the defendant was under the control of his older brother and that he showed remorse. I think those two things would have influenced the jury, and there was no direct evidence that he was under the control of his brother. And moreover, the only time he showed any emotion or remorse was when his aunt testified. And if he had been under the control of his brother, there would have been some remorse afterward when his brother was no longer directly controlling him, but there wasn't. I think we should accept the fact that the jury was right, that this guy wanted to kill as many people as possible. He did his best to do it, and he showed absolutely no remorse about it. And those things resonate with the jury, and they're perfectly appropriate for the jury to take into account under the statute as it was passed by Congress and as it was signed by the president. We can have an argument that we shouldn't have a death penalty. I get that. I respect the people on the other side. But we have one, and
that's understood, George. Yeah, George Vian, I'd love to ask you though about the point that Nancy Gertner, that Judge Gertner, made a moment ago, and that is to have the prosecution of a federal death penalty case in a state where the majority of the folks oppose the death penalty. A WBUR poll last month showed that only 31% of Boston area residents supported the death penalty for Tsarnaev. What does that do, in your view, to the thinking about a case like this? Or is it just immaterial?
Well, a couple of things. One, I'm always skeptical about polling information. And when it was put to a vote, I thought the majority of people in Massachusetts actually voted for the death penalty. But regardless of all that, we're dealing here with a death-qualified jury, which is required under the law, which is a group of people who would say, in the appropriate case, I could impose the death penalty. So those are the people who are making the decisions, not the general population in Massachusetts, however the general population feels about it. But look, it's a federal case. We have a federal government. The federal government passed the statute. They applied the statute in this case. And the defendant committed a truly monstrous crime, showed absolutely no remorse for it. I think the jury did a good job in applying the law and sentenced him to death.
Judge Nancy Gertner, if I could just bring you back in here. I mean, I'm struck by what George Vian has said a couple times now in the past few minutes, that he believes it would have made a difference if Jahar Tsarnaev had shown some remorse. And this brings to mind the testimony that we heard from Sister Helen Prejean in basically the final hours of this trial. She testified that Jahar Tsarnaev showed her remorse in the jailhouse, saying that, according to her, that Tsarnaev said no one deserved, the death or injuries that they got in the bombings. I mean, in retrospect, if he's going to say that in the jailhouse, was it a mistake for them to not put Tsarnaev on the stand?
What you don't know how someone would stand up to cross-examination. You don't know what his taking the stand would have, other evidence that it would have enabled. There are lots of things, actually, we think we know about this case. There are lots of things we don't know. Portions of the judge's rulings about the jury, about other evidentiary issues, were sealed. So we don't know what, we don't know whether or not all the evidence that could have been presented was presented. We don't know what those are. And the if the, with putting a, what is it, a 21-year-old on the stand to resist cross-examination is always an issue for a defense lawyer. One doesn't know what that, why that decision was made. I might add that it's often the case that the moment when a defendant testifies is usually the only significant moment in a trial. Whatever else you had in the case pales before that moment. So it is not unusual that defendants don't testify, no matter who they are. And we see that all the time. Everything else you've done in the case pales before that moment, and it's high stakes, and it's not surprising that he wouldn't be asked to testify.
Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and Harvard Law School professor, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And George Vian is a former federal prosecutor. He was the prosecutor in the Gary Lee Sampson case. George Vian, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to the conversation about how the sentence affects the community at large. And to have that conversation, we're joined by Liz Walker. She's pastor of the Roxbury Presbyterian Church. Pastor Walker, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. A fascinating conversation.
Well, can I hear you, your reaction is to the verdict?
Well, I come at it from a religious, a spiritual, and a moral standpoint, and I don't believe in a God who calls for or condones vengeance. So I was not against it. I understand the crime. I understand the heinous nature of it. I believe the government proved its case, but the issue is bigger than that for me. You know, I argue that this verdict is, or the sentencing is beneath us. It's beneath us as you know, human beings who believe in the dignity of life and the value of life. To me, it's vengeance dressed up as justice. And just because the state or the government is behind it doesn't make it morally correct.
Mm. Well, I mean, on that point, a little earlier you heard we had a conversation with Liz Norden, whose two sons were gravely wounded by the bombings. And to mm-hmm. her, she feels a sense of closure, a sense of justice. I mean, what would you tell, would you tell her and, you know, other survivors or victims who may feel the same way?
I wouldn't begin to try to debate or discuss that with someone who's experienced something I have not. Mm. I certainly can appreciate and understand that she's at a different level of life, but I do believe that there is trauma and pain that's so deep that you are speaking from that. And I wonder, you know, if that's all there is to say about such a case. But I certainly am not going to take on anyone who has gone through the horror of losing someone or having right. someone, you know. But the bigger picture to me is this kind of sentencing doesn't say so much about, it does say something about us as people, those of us who impose it. Because if you go suffering for suffering, eye for an eye, it just goes on and on and on. And I, you know, while certainly the survivors have the right to speak of justice as they see it, I wonder if there is closure here. And I don't believe that the death of this man is going to end the pain or compensate for death or restore mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm sure this woman who said this doesn't believe that, even though, you know, for her this may be justice right. now.
Well, Liz Walker, if I may ask you then, how do you believe Boston can fully heal, can move forward now?
Well, we have to move forward. Yeah. And I think part of it is talking about this. I think this is really important what you're doing tonight, because we don't think about this. We don't have to think about it, most of us. And I really respect those jurors, because even though they were called so-called death qualified, meaning they were willing to impose the death penalty as part of their being selected, this is a difficult decision. Who could take on a decision of deciding who lives and who dies? In my tradition, that belongs to God. So I think speaking about it is the first step to healing, and you know, and calling your pain pain. We live in a world full of trauma, a global trauma. My neighborhood where I preach is an inner city neighborhood where anger and pain are simmering. Mm-hmm. That's not unlike the pain that simmers in the Middle East. So I think that, you know, to begin to deal with it is to talk about it, not necessarily just to kill, but to talk about it and see if there's something more constructive that can come out of a horror like this. And I hope that these conversations will continue.
Well, speaking of that, Reverend Walker, and speaking of your congregation, I have to believe that you're thinking about what you might be saying this weekend to your congregation.
Well, as it is, I'm not preaching this weekend, but I am thinking about this
sure.
in terms of what is the message that goes ahead. And I, you know, there's a scripture that's vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And it says anything that has to be taken care of, God will take care of it. But that comes with faith, and that's to my tradition. I think it's a difficult subject, so I don't begin to have an absolute answer to it because, like you just said, one of the survivors, one of the people who lost someone or had someone injured, is going to have a totally different look at this. But I think that what we have to do is talk about the value of life across the board, the value of life from all the way through, and see where we stand on that, and really begin to look deeply into what you know human life is worth. And then, you know, and do you have the courage to stand up and do something different? But something, justice should say what we are at our best, as far as I'm concerned. I think Cornel West said justice is what love looks like in public, which I thought was one of the best quotes. And so how does that, you know, how does that live out in our daily lives? And how can we how can we take a different look at that? So that's why I think this is an important conversation.
Sure. Liz Walker, pastor of the Roxbury Presbyterian Church. Stand by if you would. We want to go to a couple of calls, speaking of a public conversation. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Fenway. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to bring up two perspectives that I don't think I've really heard. One is there seems to be an assumption that the death penalty would be the more severe punishment, and I think, you know, the idea that life imprisonment might be, you know, the more severe punishment for someone who has committed a heinous crime, it's something we should consider because maybe he deserves the most severe punishment. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration in the context of why he may have committed the crime, and that for someone who maybe believes that they are going to receive a reward in death for this strike against America, perhaps giving that person death is not the best punishment. And then just the second point, I think, is considering the context of executing someone who made a religious, or at least a twisted religious, attack against the United States and putting them to death, I think, puts them in the position of being a martyr to at least some people. And I think considering the more global impact of not elevating someone who has made a terrorist attack on the U.S., that position might be also important to consider.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. Important point, and we're really grateful. We want to try to squeeze in one more call. We'll take them both up in a moment. Matthew is calling from Somerville. Matthew, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call, too. And it's interesting, just following on from the previous caller as well. I appreciate the meditation and the spiritual component of talking about the death penalty. If this were just a domestic case, that I would probably have a lot more sympathy with some of the speakers, but in the broader context here, the Tsarnaev did not attack the people of Massachusetts or Boston even. I mean, this was a premeditated attack on a country in what he believed was a state of war. Now we're seeing images of hostages being taken, innocent civilians all over the world by militants who believe in a similar ideology, and I thought it might be something to consider that. Had Tsarnaev not been given the death penalty, his presence and existence in our prisons might potentially have, you know, led to some terrorists taking hostages and requesting that he be freed. And that component would then rupture the closure that we're trying to achieve here locally. So I thought that was something to kind of consider in the context of this is not just about our domestic society in this particular case.
Matthew, it's a big point. We're grateful. Liz Walker, you heard a couple of thoughts there. We'd love to, before we say goodbye to you, just get a sort of parting thought from you on this day, on this difficult chapter for the city.
Yeah, interesting points, compelling points, and I think good points. I think what we're seeing here is a group of thoughtful people who are really, you know, responding to a situation that I consider a crisis, and not just this situation in Boston, but the world is in crisis right now. And you know, to me, there is a thread of similarity in gang violence in the streets of Boston and terrorism in the world. And I'm going to be radically radical to say that. And we have to begin to look at what are some of the common issues that are rising up. Wrong actions, wrong motives, not in any way condoning any acts of violence, but that's what I'm saying. I'm not condoning any acts of violence. And violence as a way to stop violence, be it global or street, there's something wrong there. So I just want us to continue to think about that. And I'll certainly lift up the victims and the families who are still suffering. And I promise you we'll get no real closure from this sentence. And our hearts go out to them. We pray for them and lift them up, that somehow, you know, peace will come.
All right. The Reverend Liz Walker, pastor at Roxbury Presbyterian Church. And by the way, she spoke at the Interfaith Prayer Service at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross, which was just held a few days after the Marathon bombing in 2013. Reverend Walker, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
We are talking about the decision by the jury at Boston Federal Court today to hand down the death penalty to Jahar Tsarnaev. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We want to hear from you in this special hour of Radio Boston. There is a wide variety of reaction and opinion regarding the death sentence. We have some tweets here. Jason Hurley sent us a tweet saying, "You ease pain by transcending savagery, not perpetuating it." Rosemary Keene sent us a tweet saying, "A shocking outcome forced on Massachusetts by federal law and prosecutors. State killings do not make us safer." But you heard earlier from the mother of some survivors who said she feels justice was done. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is a special edition of Radio Boston.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're continuing our special coverage on the sentencing of Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev earlier today. A federal jury sentenced him to death on 6 of 17 capital counts. Carlos Arredondo has been at the courthouse every day watching the trial. He was watching the marathon, wearing a cowboy hat when the bombs went off, and ran toward the blasts to help people. Among those he helped, Jeff Bowman, who lost both of his legs in the bombing.
We spoke with Carlos Arredondo earlier today as he was still processing what the verdict means after such a long trial.
It's not a day to celebrate or be cheering, you know. It's a day to look back on to everything that happened and think on the survivors and the family of the victims.
Carlos, let me ask you, though, as you know, the jury could have gone one of two ways, life in prison or the death penalty. They chose the death penalty. Do you agree with that? Was that the right decision?
You know, some of us didn't want for him to get away easily. We was hoping that he can, you know, spend some time in jail, like that he can, you know, figure out what happened here and pay the price or what he done. But this is the way it come out, you know, so we just dealing with that right now. I was hoping that he can go back to jail and the rest of his life in a hole.
Right, right. You were hoping that he could spend the rest of his life in jail.
That's correct.
Yeah. There is likely going to be a long appeals process, which will keep this case very much in the news in the years ahead. Are you concerned about that?
Of course, and that's one thing we was hoping to avoid. Mm-hmm. You know, I was hoping that he paid, you know, with long days in jail. That's one thing I wanted. Now we have to deal with the appeals and all that.
Do you feel that justice has been served, though?
Oh, no, justice has been served, of course, you know, because all this, we get what we got, and pretty much we're going to move on with our lives and trying to figure out, you know, what happened here in the next few days.
Yeah. Well, now that this trial is over, how does it change your life?
Now I can go back to my normal life, like, and trying to move on from all this. And at the same time, I want to have more time to spend with my friend Jeff and his family and friends, and that it's going to be wonderful. Yeah.
All right. Well, Carlos Arredondo, the man in the cowboy hat, you're a good man. Thank you for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you very much again. Bye-bye.
And Carlos Arredondo and his wife, Melita, have started a new foundation to help military families who are affected by suicide called the Arredondo Family Foundation.
Let's take some calls here. David's calling from Hingham. You're on the air, David.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for the call. You know, first of all, I am somebody who has lost a child in my life, and I'll say, as a general rule, there is no closure when you lose something, somebody like that. Second, generally, I am somebody who is opposed to death penalty because of capital punishment. I think it's been applied discriminatory way in our country, and a lot of people have been let off death row when we add scientific evidence. I think the issue to be decided in this case is not a matter of vengeance. I think the issue to be decided in this case by the jury is what is the correct punishment for the crime committed.
And in this case, do you believe they chose the correct punishment?
In this case, I think death is the just punishment for somebody who causes the death of four people. Causes horrific injuries, traumatic amputations, etc. on the spot. This is the just punishment.
David, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I do want to get in one more caller as well, but I very much appreciate your thoughts, David. Let's go to Jay, who's calling from Belmont. You're on the air, Jay.
Oh, hello. I really think it reduces our whole society to murder someone who kills. It reduces us to the same level. And we're the only country in the first world who has capital punishment, and I wish it would be done away with.
Jay, thank you so much for your call. So, Anthony, just right there, the spectrum of opinion on this sentence right here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and we've really been hearing it throughout the hour. Very interesting, very heartfelt opinions. Let's check in with WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. He co-hosts the WBUR podcast Finish Line inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial, and, of course, he's been the lead reporter at federal court throughout this whole trial. David, I know you've been listening. I've got some specific questions about what happens next, but I'd love to get your reaction to what you've been hearing from this range of reactions from our listeners.
You know, I continue to be struck, Anthony, that we have this debate now about the death penalty after it has been imposed by a jury. And I keep on thinking the time for all of this was January 2014, because at the end of January, the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, decided to go forward with a death penalty case against Tsarnaev. Once he did that, the train had left the station. So we now have, for instance, the Boston Globe editorializing against the death penalty. We had this very touching letter by the Richards about opposing the death penalty. And we've had Sister Helen Prejean in court talking about the death penalty to the extent that she could. All of this comes after the process had begun. The time for this to have taken place would have been before January, I think it was January 30th, 2014. At that point, nothing was going to change this train. It wasn't going to turn it around. And so it led where it inevitably led to today.
So what happens next? U.S. District Judge George O'Toole has to officially hand out the death penalty. How does that happen? Right. When does it happen? What do we know about that?
It's maybe a couple of months, maybe more than that. There's going to be a formal hearing. The sentence will be imposed. But the important thing for the families is that victim impact statements will then be allowed by the victims and their families. Zahar Tsarnaev might choose to speak. He'll have the opportunity then. And then we go into this process, this endless process, you know, that we see from federal death penalty cases where the appeals take place. What we know, and it's important to remember, there was somebody else in a federal trial here earlier in Boston, Gary Sampson, who was convicted, who was sentenced to death, and that was overturned. It was overturned on an issue of one of the jurors' statements in the jury selection process. You're going to see, among other things, you're going to see appeals based on the selection of this jury, I believe, and how it was done. There are going to be numerous appeals. The defense is going to do whatever it can to appeal this case, but I can see that there already are issues that are coming forward. Right. One of them, by the way, I should just add, is, if you have time, is that the jurors had said, some of them had said they presumed he was guilty but could set that apart. The question is, with the pool that was of 1,273 jurors, why didn't the judge dump anybody who said they'd preformed an opinion, even if they said they could set it aside? So that, for instance, I predict is going to be an issue in the appellate process.
David, I have to say, we've just got 50 seconds left, and this isn't a question but rather just an accolade. You have been in the courthouse day in and day out from the start of this trial, and I know that so many Bostonians listening to you every day have come to rely on your reporting and analysis. So just a huge heartfelt thank you to you and the WBUR team there.
Here, here.
Thank you. That's very gracious of you. But let me tell you, every moment I've been here, I've been cognizant of the honor of serving this community and those people whose lives were affected and affected forever that day in April of 2013.
WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. David, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, that concludes a special hour of Radio Boston on the sentencing of Jahar Tsarnaev. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.